Tales from the Rails, discovering the Stockton and Darlington Railway, the railway that got the world on track.
Hello and welcome to our third Tales from the Rails, our monthly podcast on the Stockton and Darlington Railway, the railway that got the world on track. My name is Caroline Hardy.
And my name is Archie Mackay.
I'm an archaeologist and the editor and trustee for the charity The Friends of the Stockton and Darlington Railway.
And I'm managing editor of Southwestern News, a small independent publisher of four community newspapers, including the Shildon and District Town Crier, produced right here in the cradle of the railways.
As usual, we're also joined by Cleo the dog, who doesn't make much of a contribution to these podcasts. But hopefully, going to make much more of a splash, is Niall Hammond, chair of the Friends of the S&DR. Hello, Niall.
Hello, Caroline and Archie.
I should mention that this week we're also joined by Bonnie, the Southwestern News office dog, or news hound, as I prefer to call her. It's her first time joining us in these podcasts, so it'll be interesting to see whether she and Cleo do decide to get involved this week.
Hello, Bonnie. So now, how do you get roped into it? How did you come to have this privileged and honoured position as chair of the Friends of the Stockton and Darlington Railway?
Well, it's a long journey, really, and we could probably fill a whole podcast on that one. But as an 11-year-old boy, I attended the 1975 celebrations, and it's always stuck in my mind that it's just a fantastic, internationally important place. So when, about 10 years ago, a group of people got together to see if they could get people working together for the 2025 celebrations, I was keen to participate. And it all just sort of grew a bit out of control from there, really.
Right, okay, so in the interest of transparency, although I'm not entirely sure that's the right word, I should also say that Niall's actually my husband as well, which is his most honoured position, obviously. Anyway, well, this week on Tales from the Rails,
we're going to focus on the world's earliest railway station, which is Hyington Station at Aycliffe Lane, and the Friends of the S&DR's campaign to rescue it.
As usual, we'll also, in Stars of the S&DR, find out much more about the pioneering people who worked on the railway. And this month will be all about John Falkus Carter, who designed and oversaw the construction of many S&DR buildings, including Hyington Station.
We'll also be letting you know about events that are coming down the line. So fetch your diaries, make a cup of tea, put your feet up, and enjoy the ride on the railway that got the world on track.
Tales from the Rails. This podcast is brought to you by the Friends of the Stockton and Darlington Railway, a registered charity set up to safeguard and promote the heritage of the railway that got the world on track. You can join us by visiting our website at www.sdr1825.org.uk.
So, just before we start, I have a favour to ask. However you are listening to this, somewhere on the screen there will be a subscribe button. Please, could you press that? It really helps us, and in return, we promise to keep improving these podcasts.
The 27th of September, 1825. The day that changed the face of the world.
So, Niall, where is Hyington Station?
Well, it's not in Hyington. That would be a bit too easy. In its life, it's also been called Aycliffe Lane Station, but it wasn't in Aycliffe Village either. So when built, it was roughly halfway between the two villages of Aycliffe and Hyington, not far from what was then the Great North Road, what today we think of as the A1, and the proximity to that is really important. So it's located at a level crossing where the Stockton and Darlington Railway crosses Aycliffe Lane, and if you want to drive to find it, the postcode is DL56QG, or why not just catch a train there from Darlington or Shildon?
Now, for those listeners from further afield, I'm just going to point out that there is another Hyington in Lincolnshire. Our Hyington is in County Durham.
This is a significant spot. Before the station was built, it was where Active, later known as Locomotion No. 1, was put on the line.
The Superior Locomotive Travelling Engine was loaded onto a road dray provided by the Pickersgill Company to convey it from Robert Stevenson & Co. in Newcastle, where it had been built, to the Stockton and Darlington Railway on Thursday evening, the 15th of September 1825. It departed behind an 8-strong team of Pickersgill's horses on Friday morning the 16th, arriving at Aycliffe Lane on the 18th.
Incidentally, at our History Day in Hinton recently, we met a number of descendants of the Pickersgill family. It's amazing that they're still in the area and haven't moved themselves further afield.
On the 18th September, the locomotive arrived at this very spot. It had cost the railway company £600 and was delivered much later than anticipated. The locomotive was named Active, but would later be known as Number 1 Engine or Locomotion Number 1.
Its arrival was witnessed by many people who turned out to see Iron Horse, many of whom assisted with the removal of the locomotive from the dray onto the track. They included two brothers, Robert and James Robinson, who recalled their experience 50 years later in the Northern Echo. The crowd also included three other lads aged about 13, including one Crawford Marley. When the engine had been placed on the rails, the lads were asked by George Stevenson's elder brother, James, known as Jem, who was supervising the operation, to help fill the boiler with water. They ran to a nearby farmhouse to borrow some buckets and filled the boiler with water from a nearby spring. Once steam had been raised, Crawford Marley and his two unnamed friends, who had helped with the watering, were given a ride on the locomotive, the railway's first passengers. However, before it could get going, the boiler had to be lit. Some years later, the endeavours to light the fire were recalled by a labourer, Robert Metcalf, who was employed on the line.
Number one came to Hinton Lane by road. We had to get her on the way. When we got her on the way, we pumped water into her and sent John Taylor for a lantern and candle to Wakeliffe. When we'd done that, I thought I'd have me pipe. It was a very warm day though, being back end of the year. I took me pipe glass and lit me pipe. I thought myself, I'd try to put fire to Jimmy Ockham. It blazed away well. The fire gone rapidly. Lantern and candle was near used to no one, so fire was put to her online by the pour of the sun. 8 wagons was all she could trail.
Thank you so much to Lee Morris for getting through that mouthful of 19th century southwest Durham.
As we know, the railway officially opened on the 27th of September 1825, and so the first part of what we think of today as our modern railway network was underway. Next, the railway company gave some thought to improving the service at this level crossing.
Incidentally, did you know that there was a specification for level crossings agreed in the 1821 Act of Parliament for the S&DR? It said the ledge or flange of such railways or tramroads for the purpose of guiding the wheels of the carriages shall not exceed 3 inches in height above the level of such road. So, a level crossing is a great place for road and rail to interact. In October 1825, the S&DR's Management Committee resolved that a siding for the accommodation of the public in the delivery of coals be made at Aycliffe Lane. They also made the same instruction for Fighting Cocks and early Nook depots. This was a place where the public could buy coal delivered by rail. A month later, lime was also being delivered here, probably mostly used by farmers to improve their soil, but also as a building material. By early 1827, stone was being delivered here too, presumably also for building.
Meanwhile, the public were coming to the level crossing to catch a train or use the depot, but there was no shelter and no place to obtain refreshments. It was a bleak place and not somewhere you'd want to hang around. Even the staff only had temporary cabins at the depot.
The S&DR decided to improve their offer along the line by providing stopping places next to depots and roads where shelter and refreshments could be obtained. They commissioned 3 inns, one at Stockton, one at Darlington and one at Aycliffe Lane.
These weren't the first inns on the railway. The company had rented an existing inn, the Mariner's Tavern, on Stockton's quayside next to their wharves and warehouses. And that ever-opportunistic chair of the S&DR, Mr. Maynell, had one built in 1825 at the end of the Yarm Branch, the new inn, now called the Cleveland Bay. It's still a pub.
In September 1826, the S&DR company approved a plan of a cottage and other conveniences to be built at Aycliffe Lane. It let the building contracts on the best terms to Story and Sons and Michael Windale.
The S&DR's architect was their occasional clerk of works and inspector of buildings, John Carter, a master mason by profession from Hinton, who became the designer of many of the company's early buildings and structures. He designed the building as a two-storey structure, as seen from the railway track, but the railway company insisted that he reduce it in scale. Carter pointed out to the railway company that it'd be far cheaper to build the larger version of the building now instead of increasing in size later, but his advice was ignored. It was advertised on the 7th of May, 1827, alongside the new Darlington House, as follows.
To be let by proposal, that means they're inviting tenders to run the inn and depot. Two good new-built dwelling houses belonging to the Stockton and Darlington Railway Company. Number one, situate at the Skern Bridge, Darlington, immediately opposite the company's depots. Number two, situate at Aycliffe and Hyington Lane, touching upon the said railway and adjoining the company's depots there. The above may be entered on immediately. An application is intended to be made to the magistrates for licences for the said houses as inns at the next licensing day, when it's expected they will become places of considerable business.
Seven people submitted bids to run the inn and the depot, but they decided to appoint Matthew Turnbull and his family to run it, despite not being the cheapest. But disaster struck. The licence to sell booze was refused.
Who refused the licence to booze? Well, the magistrates did, and those magistrates often had vested interests in the Turnpike Road network, so in County Durham at least, they had it in for the railway. One of the key magistrates behind the decision was William Price Cumby, a heroic commander of the Bellerophon, known as the Billy Ruffian ship at Trafalgar, and resident of Hyington at Trafalgar House. Hero of the Battle of Trafalgar he may have been, but he was no hero to the railways.
Ooh.
The railway company were livid. When we see a whole bench of magistrates in order to gratify the private resentments of one individual or more of their number heap injuries upon a community, we become sensible that theirs is a power which can render even the best designed institutions mischievous and destructive. We think the system of licensing public houses at present in force in this country liable to a perversion of this sort.
So what is a tavern to do when it can't sell alcohol? Well, it carried on with its other functions of running the depot, providing shelter and non-alcoholic refreshments, while appeals were organised by the SNDR.
Those appeals provided evidence of just how much activity was going on there. So we learned that the proposed public house would provide a service to users of the freight depots, but it was an important part of the company's case that its usefulness was somewhere where coach travellers could shelter and refresh and where unaccompanied parcels could be safely received and dropped off. Some of the witnesses indicate that the latter of these was already happening on an informal basis when convenient for Matthew Turnbull, the landlord. So even before the company and Mr. Turnbull obtained the licence, eventually in 1829, the building was functioning as a railway station, albeit without alcohol. So let's look at some of the extracts from the appeals which were reported in the local press. This from the railway company itself.
The Aycliffe Lane House immediately adjoins the railway between Aycliffe and Hyington. To that spot persons come in the most stormy seasons at all hours of the day and night to load and unload goods and to await the arrival and departure of the numerous coaches and carriages which now traverse the railway. It is indeed the only place for a considerable distance where such individuals could procure any refreshment. We are at a loss to account for the determined hostility that appears to have been evinced to these applications. An Englishman ought to claim as a right a permission of this sort, and the task of a magistrate, if he should be invested with any jurisdiction at all in such a matter, should be confined to the simple act of seeing that it was only granted to persons who were not likely to abuse the privilege.
So that came from the Durham Chronicle on the 15th of September 1827. And John Hill was one of many appearing at the appeal for the railway company.
There is a considerable passage of parcels and goods of every description on the railway for the villages of Aycliffe and Hyington. I've taken up parcels myself at that house and seen many more people there for the same purpose. If there were no such house there, a coach would be under the necessity of taking the things up to Shildon, which is 3 miles further. If a passenger wants to get into the coach, let the weather be ever so stormy, he should be exposed to it, for there is no place wherein he could shelter. This house of Turnbull's would be, in my opinion, a convenience for receiving parcels and the use of persons wishing to go by the coach. There is no place near there for people to put parcels.
John Priorman was another witness.
I often receive parcels by the coach. I consider it would be a benefit to me and all the country round to have a public house there. I think a public house would be useful in this particular place on the ground that we have to lead coal and lime from its immediate vicinity and have no place to put either carts or horses when we have to wait. Parcels coming for me are sometimes left at Turnbull's, sometimes down below. We do not always get them conveniently. This place is noted for good coals and many people go there on that account. I have had to wait an hour and a half myself.
The company later put forward their case at another appeal reported in the Newcastle Courant on the 31st of October 1829. The situation was particularly favourable, and it was a point to which persons resident in those places must necessarily draw, who had parcels to send or receive, and who had to travel by the coaches which passed there to Auckland, Darlington and Stockton. And surely a man was not to be kept standing on the railway waiting for a coach, or to lay his goods, perhaps valuable there, until a conveyance came to the spot. Interestingly, a witness said that as well as being 4 or 5 yards from the railway, there are 3 or 4 steps up to the house. Well, I was looking at some old photographs recently from the 1950s, and there are actually only 2 steps up to the front door now, which makes me think that maybe the cobbled railway platform, which is meant to be the earliest railway platform in the world, might actually date after 1829. And a couple of steps have been buried below the platform. Anyway, the evidence also shone a line light on other pioneering aspects of the railway.
Another witness said that the house would have to be kept open all night, but the character of the landlord would be sufficient protection against disorderly or profligate practices. The solicitor for the railway company, Mr. Mewburn, said that they were very strict over the conduct of all their servants on the railway, employing a policeman to preserve order amongst the workmen, and inspecting public houses already on the railway, to see that they did not encourage the workmen or farmers, servants, etc., to tipple away their time and waste their money.
Yeah, perish the thought. So the S&DR was employing railway policemen before the creation of the Metropolitan Police by Robert Peel. And that reference to other public houses already on the railway is a reminder that the tavern at St John's Crossing in Stockton had got its licence straight away in 1827, and privately owned wayside taverns were being constructed elsewhere along the line at depots. But not all of them had the wider functions found at Hyington. Anyway, the licence was finally obtained in 1829 after appeals being refused 3 times, but only after the law was changed to stop magistrates with improper motives refusing such applications, and the building, the depot and its staff could get on with their jobs and enjoy the refreshing benefits of a beer while doing so.
The idea of a station was soon expanded by the company. On 23rd April 1830, the management committee ordered that a cottage for the accommodation of passengers and parcels and the sale of coals, lime, etc. be immediately built at Fighting Cock's Lane, together with the one intended to be built at Yarm Branch.
So that's quite interesting, because here we see the company commissioning what is in effect railway stations, the one at Fighting Cock's being next to a depot. And at Fighting Cock's, the tavern element had already been provided by the private landowner in the area.
Although the building at Hyington, and indeed Fighting Cock's, had the functions of a station, because the railway station hadn't really been invented before, there was no common vocabulary to describe it. So for the next few years, the railway company tended to refer to them as cottages. This was a term they used for all their buildings, regardless of function. The locals probably just referred to it as Turnbulls. Hackworth, in writing his notes about it, the death of John Cree in 1828, referred to it as the watering station. The watering, of course, was for the engines, not the drivers. In 1832, it was being called a railway inn. In 1834, it was called the King's Arms when it was taken over by Matthew Stevenson, who was also a farmer.
It wasn't until January 1840 that the company had started routinely using the term railway station. A committee minute headed Aycliffe Lane Station authorised the superintendent of the coaching department, that's the one that dealt with passengers, to arrange for the gatekeeper at Aycliffe Lane to ticket the passengers. In fact, the coach return records survive for some of this period, and it suggests that the station was relatively quiet, unsurprising given its the location. But the most popular destination was Darlington, especially on Mondays, which was market day, and the second most popular destination was Shildon. It operated 6 days a week for passenger traffic.
Early references during the appeal process to overnight provision may have only related to freight, especially when trying to clear bottlenecks. These happened often due to inclines breaking down or to bad weather at the port in Stockton, which prevented boats being loaded.
The spot, as well as having a depot and a station, was also a watering spot for the locomotives, as we've seen. Once the building opened, it was a watering spot for engine drivers too, and that led to a spot of conflict. The landlord was Matthew Turnbull, and he also ran the depot. His relation, Edward Turnbull, was responsible for helping to get the water into the locomotives.
On 1st of July 1828, a terrible explosion happened. When locomotion number 1 was taking in water, killing the driver John Cree on the spot and burning Edward Turnbull, who was left with lifelong black burn marks on his face. This explosion resulted in locomotion being set aside in the yard at Shildon a while, and when finally rebuilt by Timothy Hackworth with many modifications, the most noticeable being that it now had 2 chimneys.
In January 1831, the S&DR committee heard that four lines of road, i.e. track, were by then necessary at the watering place to keep two lines of road always open and allow the engines, either empty or loaded, to stand clear of those wagons while taking in water. The lime chute and the pillar for the water cistern also needed to be set back from the line.
Now, as an aside, if you've listened to our earlier podcast, you'll have heard us mention Jem Stevenson, Jem being short for James. This was George Stevenson's older brother, and he was employed by the S&DR as an engine driver, and he drove locomotion number one on the opening day. Somehow, via the surviving documentation, he's obtained a bit of a reputation for liking the drink. But further, on the 30th of January 1829, the S&DR committee recorded that James Stevenson & Co. should be fined 40 shillings for selling coals at Aycliffe Lane, the tonnage thereupon never having been accounted for to this company. So, sounds like he was selling coals on the sly for his own personal benefit.
In April 1835, when the company commissioned the repainting of the S&DR's buildings between Aycliffe Lane and Fighting Cocks, the Aycliffe Lane Inn was specifically named, its front door to be painted grained oak. A little hint of the decorative scheme we might put in place if we managed to buy and restore the building.
Between 1838 and 9, the building was extended, as John Carter had early predicted it would need to be, and by the late 1830s or early 1840s, the building stopped serving alcohol and concentrated instead on other station activities. The other S&DR taverns, which never functioned as stations, continued to serve alcohol, as this was largely their sole purpose. The building was further extended, and by the time of the 1851 census, 38-year-old Thomas Wilson was the railway station master, and he was recorded as living with his wife, seven children, and mother. That's 10 people. Alongside them in adjacent railway houses, presumably the extension, there were two other households, each headed by a railway labourer. Thomas's son William, later, 1868, took over as station master while Thomas ran the depot. Now would be a good time to hear from Jill Thompson, whose great-grandfather Robert Batty worked for the railway.
Right, Jill, tell me about your great-grandfather, Robert Batty. When was he born?
1853.
And what happened to him that left him in a bit of a sticky situation?
Well, when he was a young child, he fell on the railway lines and managed to cut off some of his fingers. So on one hand, he had a thumb and a little finger. On the other hand, he had a thumb and a first finger.
That's all he was left with?
Yes, that's right. And because it had happened on the railway, the railway company that was in charge at that time educated him.
What did they get him to do as a job after that?
They found him a job as clerk for children.
Oh, brilliant. And so then what happened?
Well, when he was 18, he wanted to join the union, and he was told he couldn't join the union because he belonged to the railway company. And so he just took umbrage at that and didn't think that was a very good idea. So as soon as he could, he saved his money up and left and came to Hannington, where he bought a pony and trap, and he did deliveries and I suppose a kind of a taxi service. He used to take people to Hannington Station or Children and Darlington, wherever they wanted to go. So he collected parcels from the railway and delivered people down there as well.
Brilliant. So he was continuing a tradition that actually started in 1827. So he settled in Hannington forever, did he?
Yes, he bought two houses in Hannington, number 15 and number 17 Churchview. And he stabled his horse at the back of the house, and the stables were still there up until 2000, I suppose.
Have they been demolished now?
I think they've been converted. I haven't seen what's happened. Okay, I'm dying to ask the people who live now to let me have a look through. But
so how long did he work for doing that job?
36 years.
Right, so he retired in 1907.
And he was awarded the Imperial Medal from the King for his service to the community.
Brilliant. That sounds well deserved. Thank you, Jill.
So I guess that when Robert was little, the railway company that looked after him might still have been the S&DR, as it didn't amalgamate with the Northeastern Railway until 1863, by which time Robert was 10 and was probably already eight fingers down. But I suspect when he asked to join a union and was told he belonged to the railway, that would be the Northeastern Railway.
Anyway, back to Hannington Station. Sometime between 1871 and 1881, a short terrace of five houses called Station Cottages was built by the railway company. by now the North Eastern Railway Company, about 150 yards south of the station buildings at the far end of the depot yard.
The building continued to function as a railway station with attached accommodation for railway staff until the late 1960s. We've had some lovely photos sent to us by people who lived in these cottages. Do take a look at our Save Hyington Station Facebook page and enjoy what appears to be an idyllic childhood. Talking of childhoods at Hyington, here's a more recent recollection from Jill Thompson once again. This time, it's about her mother, Rosemary Boynton, a typical superwoman juggling work and young children in the late 1950s.
Hey, Jill, tell me about your mum, Rosemary Boynton, because she sort of continued the tradition of your great-grandfather.
Yes, during the late 50s, so around about that time. Don't know the exact date. My mum got offered a job as postwoman in the village. Someone was poorly and they needed somebody to step in. So for several years, she was postwoman in the village. And when we were growing up, she would go and sort her letters first in the post office and come back home and get us up out of bed, go and do part of her round, come back and give us our breakfast and get us on the school buses, and then complete her rounds after that. She used to go down to School Acre through, it's now called North Sky Road, but it used to be Bakelite when I was young, going to Hyington Station, deliver their letters and at the station houses. And then the two farms on the way back up the other road. And that was her round. But during school holidays, about the time when my elder sister would be 9, I would be 6, my younger sister was 3, we often, when she came to do the trip round the farm, we would go with her. So my three-year-old sister Dawn used to ride on the front of the post bike. And Heather and I followed on our own bikes. Followed all around, went to School Acres through Bakelite, the Hyington Station, where we'd all got a club biscuit, I believe we all used to get.
Oh, I love those.
As I say, then we followed up back to Hyington, and she was finished by about 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock on the morning.
That's amazing, isn't it? I mean, yeah. Juggling 3 children and work.
And my dad was a long-distance lorry driver, so he wasn't around some of the time.
That's astonishing. So you mentioned earlier a little accident you had at one point.
Oh, yes, I quite. We'd done this on our school holidays, obviously every day other than the Sunday. And I was riding along one morning and I thought, I bet I could do this with my eyes closed. So very cleverly shut my eyes, went over the top of my bike, landed in a gravel pit just about. So I remember being taken to Hyington Station. It was just near Hyington Station. And sat on the counter while somebody painstakingly cleaned my knees and cleaned my hand, ready for me to go home.
I can remember what it's like having the gravel picked out of your knees. It's quite painful.
Although you used to have a yellow ointment that you used to put on.
Ashford
flavouring, I think it was called, or something like that.
I think that was probably a 2 club biscuit day.
Oh, yeah, I should think so, yes.
Thank you.
By 1970, the building was no longer used by the railway and it was becoming derelict. Originally sold off to Sedgefield Borough Council, eventually it opened as a pub, the Locomotion No. 1, around 1980 with yet another extension. It closed in the mid-2010s and failed to sell at auction in December 2017, after which its guide price offer was reduced, but it still stands empty today and sadly, as with any empty building, it's been vandalised. Trains on the Bishop Auckland branch line from Darlington, part of the original 1825 S&DR, still stop regularly at the unmanned halts next door. And so, just as in the early days, there is no shelter, sadly no refreshments, and it's once again a bit of a bleak spot.
And this is where the Friends of the S&DR campaign comes in to save Hyington Station. But first, let's hear from a couple of our supporters.
Hello, Margaret. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Thank you, Caroline. I'm Margaret Fenwick. I'm a member of the Friends of the Stockland Arlington Railway, and I live about a mile away from Hyington Station. I think it deserves saving because it's a charismatic building, or it will be when we've spent some money on it. We can use it for a number of things, a heritage centre, a museum, a cafe, a visitor centre. The possibilities are endless.
My name is Jim Atkinson, Councillor Jim Atkinson. I'm a county councillor for the Acreth East and I'm a town councillor for Acreth Central. I'm also a member of the Friends of the Stockland Darlington Railway. Originally, I come from Witton Park. I know a fair bit about the history. And of course, this is at the very beginning of the history, which is It's a masterpiece, a masterful piece of heritage and things like that. So we really do need to hang on to it. And we need to do as much as we possibly can to hang on to it as well. So we're going to do that. We're going to try out. We've been at it a long time now because we've been the friends 2013 and onwards. And it's been a long journey. It's been a hard trek. And there's a lot of hard work being done. And I've been there to watch most of the other people do tons and tons of work. So it's a great asset and we really do need to save it.
What do you think would be a great end use for this building?
Well, I think there's a number of things you could do with it. Like it could be a place of education. It could be a sort of watering hole where people can stop off. But when we get our visit, it'll be somewhere for them to see. They're going to want to come and see it, aren't they? They'll bring the money and spend a few quid around the doors and things like that. So, yeah, a great asset. We must hang on to it. We must make it work. I think it'll make itself work, to be fair.
Yeah, I have to say, watering hole gets my vote.
Oh, yeah.
Some decent beer.
Yeah, yeah. We'll find all the right people to look into that. There'll be lots of people who know how to do that one.
Brilliant. Thanks very much, Jim.
That's lovely.
Cleo, why do you think we should save Harrington Station? She's a dog. Hello, Chris. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Chris Lloyd. I am chief feature writer at the Northern Echo and I dabble in local history.
And why do you think we should save Harrington Station, Chris?
I think it provides a real connection back to the earliest days, the very earliest days of the railways, 1825. And just with a little imagination, you can transport yourself back through time to the opening day of the railway. You can see locomotion number one actually passing along there. And you can see the people milling around here. And of course, even before the opening day of the railway, this is where locomotion number one was put on the tracks somehow. And there's that fantastic story. You can imagine it being bolted together just over there. And because John Walker of Stockton had yet to invent the match, they couldn't get the boiler lit, according to the story. And so they sent someone back down this road here, back into Aycliffe, to try and get a lantern of some sort. But a chap called Robert Metcalfe, I think, from Darlington, just happened to be hanging around smoking his pipe. And he allegedly used the rays of the sun to get the locomotion up and running before the lantern. We've got lantern. So all that wonderful history takes place just here. Locomotion number one exploded here, didn't it, in 1828, killing its driver quite terribly and making his pumper look like a Dalmatian for the rest of his life. Exploded hot water. So all of that sort of stuff takes place just here. And so this building kind of represents all of that and means that you can actually touch and feel that history. So I get excited by just getting people to be kind of hands-on on their history. And that's what this building represents. It would be so embarrassing if in 2025 people turned up from around the world and just came to see a site of complete dereliction where these world-changing events took place.
So what do you think would make a good use for the building once it's been restored, assuming you don't want to blow up any more engine drivers?
No, well, the obvious thing to do is to It can't just kind of stay there with no use. So it has to kind of wash its face, I believe, is a modern terminology for these things. So it has to operate either as some form of a holiday home or as a, and there would be people, I think, who would be interested, railway people from around the world, who'd be interested in staying in the world's first station. That's a great selling point. And the other thing is to make use of it as a pub or a restaurant of some sort. People are talking about it being a Georgian themed pub. And I'm not a great fan of dressing up, but it will. And that sort of thing does take it back to its original time. And of course, it is so important. These things don't just stand there as museum pieces that people can kind of get inside and see them all. And so that would be an ideal use.
So now, what's happened so far on the campaign to save Harrington Station?
Well, it's a bit of a long haul, really. We've been talking with Durham County Council as the planning body for several years now. They commissioned some surveys to identify what its historic importance was and what condition it was in and the costs of repair. But eventually that sort of task of taking it forward has been passed to the Friends. So we've worked with Historic England in particular with all this research we've been talking about, and we're really pleased that it's been upgraded from a humble Grade 2 listed building to a Grade 2 star, which puts it in the top 8% of historic buildings in the country, and also importantly gets it onto the Heritage at Risk Register, which makes it, in theory, easier to get grant aid to try and do something with it. As it stands at the moment, it's in a pretty poor condition. The outside fabric isn't too bad, but internally it's a wreck. And it needs an awful lot of very practical things doing to it to make it a usable building again and really release its potential. Because, you know, when you look at what railways mean to the wider world. This is the world's first railway station. It should be something as a region, as a country, we sing and dance about and make the most of. So its potential is huge. It's going to be on the walking cycling route all along the 26 miles of the S&DR. It's hopefully still of use to the villages of Hyington and Aycliffe. It's right on the edge of the Newton Aycliffe Business Park with all those big businesses on it. So again, somewhere really useful for them. It's next to the University Technical College, where we hope the history of the railways will inspire their students to things. So in terms of potential as a business and as a tourist attraction, as a community facility, it's got an awful lot going to it.
And does that include keeping it in hospitality as originally designed?
Well, at the moment, we're working on a business plan because clearly, although we're passionate about it just as a building and a heritage feature, it's clearly, like any building, got to earn its keep. So in the first instance, we want it to operate as a railway inn, somewhere if you're local you can call into, somewhere if you're a tourist on the walking cycling route you can call into, and you can feel like you're back in the 1830s. So we won't be serving bizarre recipes from the 1830s like pig's trotters. We can reassure you of an interesting menu and decent drinks, but it will be a living history feeling to the whole thing and somewhere where you can hopefully enjoy events as well.
Will we get to dress up?
Oh, well, there's always opportunities for dressing up, both for staff and for visitors.
Excellent. And so how much is this all going to cost?
That's the frightening thing. Nothing is cheap these days, especially when you're dealing with a Grade 2 star listed building, because Historic England will quite rightly insist on high standards. So we're looking at this in two phases. The first phase is acquire the building, because it's privately owned at the moment, and do a necessary emergency repairs, get the lights on, get the toilets working again, so we can operate and look respectable for the great celebrations in 2025. That's going to cost around about £500,000. Phase two after that will be probably more substantial, when we actually get a better understanding of how to improve the building and look at the surroundings of it, because at the moment there's a fairly bland tarmac car park and other things we could really do to make the whole place get that heritage railway feel installed in it.
So it looks respectable by 2025. In terms of the main capital works, in 2027 it'll be 200 years since the building was built, and 2029 it'll be 200 years since they finally got the license. Do you think it's possible that ultimately the works will have finished by either of those dates?
Yes. I mean, I'm an optimist at heart, but you can't underestimate how long it takes to get consents and approvals and tender work and all the boring stuff, but which is necessary. So our target at the moment is to acquire the building by September this year, which gives us the best part of a year to do those initial repair works and get it functioning and opening again. So far, that fundraising campaign's going really well. We're really grateful to everybody who's joined our crowdsource funding on Just Giving. Over 200 people have contributed to that from all over the country, in fact, Europe, not just locally. We've got grant applications in with Community Ownership Fund, Durham County Council, Rail Heritage Trust, and a variety of others. So it's a period of waiting and expectation at the moment to get the money in. So if we get it in and we buy it by this September, that first key date's going to be met. After that, then it's lots more form filling out to make those other key dates you mentioned of 2027 to celebrate its 200th birthday. And then hopefully we'll have a license by 2029.
Well, let's hope so. There are other buildings around the level crossing there, aren't there? There's a signal box. They got your beady eye on that?
Yeah, the signal box on the other side of the tracks is, again, another listed building, built quite a lot later by the North East Railway. But again, just in terms of that railway character of the whole area and just making it feel important, we've got our beadies on that because Network Rail are electrifying all their signalling. So the days of those big lever arm signals that you pulled on the box are short lived. So we're expecting that to go out of use sometime around 2029. And we've started conversations about acquiring that when it does. So hopefully when people turn up, have good time in the inn, they can go over the road and enjoy pulling some levers and understanding how historic signalling worked.
Oh, what could go wrong? Alcohol and levers. So how can people help if they want us to help save Hyington Station?
Well, clearly we're looking for a number of things. I mean, ultimately, we've got a lot of money to raise. So if people can donate money, that's fantastic. You can either write to us at the usual channels or look at our Just Giving page. You can look on the Friends website and find the Hyington Station page. And it's got all the necessary links on there. So please do donate. We're looking for help in kind. So if you're a local business or just an individual with skills, you might be an architect with some spare time. We're really keen for anybody to contribute time in kind, which again is really useful for when we're applying for grants, because people like seeing that sort of community involvement. And ultimately, just spread the word, you know, tell people about this fantastic bit of heritage on our doorstep and encourage them to come and visit us once we've got an open and usable inn that they can.
So if you want to help in any of those ways, the Friends website, well, you can just Google Friends of the Stockton and Darlington Railway and you'll find us, or it's www.sdr1825.org.uk, and you will see all the links to the Save Hyington Station campaign, and there's a contact page as well.
Yeah, I'd just like at this point, we've received a lot of help from private individuals, but there's a few people who've been fantastically helpful for us. Paul Howell, the local MP, has raised it in the House several times and has facilitated introductions.
In the House?
The House of Parliament. We've got a number of local councillors who are really keen on rail heritage, all the way from Shildon through to Aycliffe. But in particular, Jim Atkinson, who hasn't been well recently, has been a real star in this, as well as the rest of his colleagues. And also the businesses on the local industrial park, they're all getting invested in the whole S&DR thing. So Husqvarna in particular have been a real star. We're having conversations with Hitachi and a number of others. There is a list of people, which it's always the problem of forgetting some to mention somebody, but we're really grateful for all the local help and the help of our local volunteers in particular. Margaret Fennick in Hyington in particular has been a real star with this. So please, more people volunteer, more people help out.
So we'll give the last words now to Councillor David Sutton-Lloyd, who I interviewed on site a couple of weeks ago.
Hello, David. Would you like to introduce yourself?
I'm David Sutton-Lloyd. I'm one of the Durham County Councillors for Aycliffe. And I'm particularly interested in this project because of the historical content of it.
So why should we save Hyington Station?
Well, when you think this was us giving the world a railway system, and the fact that this was the exact spot where the very first Locomotion 1 started, was assembled, brought down on wagons from Stevenson's workshop in Newcastle, put together, and then that was the start of, it was a wonderful invention which has absolutely changed the world, and to lose this would be a criminal act, quite frankly. Not only that, we are able to celebrate the wonderful Northeast and its history, and especially its industrial history. When you think of the work that the Stockton and Darlington Railway is putting in towards the 2025 200 year anniversary, this on the route is just, well, it just makes sense that this should be developed. I just think what it could do for the future development and history of the link to Locomotion, where there's a lot of money being invested by the county, quite rightly, and what potential this could have for the future of Durham Tourist Trail from Stockton right up to the top of the Dales.
Absolutely. And what sort of end use do you think this building could have?
I think it's a multi-use when you just think, you know, of the heritage trail. Just think of the many millions of railway enthusiasts who would love the idea of being able to come here and buy a ticket at the station where the very first railway station was opened and the very first rail ticket was ever produced, that you could get a one here, link up as a stop on your way from, say, Stockton, exploring that wonderful history, stop here for a meal, explore the area, move on to Shildon. It's just endless. You can link into the local community. We've put a lot of work into developing pathways and cycleways. Again, why do we not think a bit broader? This could be a staging post to take out into the community. Tick, 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 tick.
Absolutely. I love the idea that you can get on the train in Shildon, get off the train at Hyington, perhaps have a fine ale in Hyington, and then perhaps walk part of the route. And it's all on the route that was taken on the 27th of September, 1820.
Yes. I mean, when you think about the historical significance of this one spot in County Durham, you know, the fact that it could be saved for generations to come, you know, it's a no-brainer, isn't it?
Tales from the Rails, steaming ahead to 2025.
So, what's coming along the line in the next month? What has happened in the last month, especially in relation to the S&DR ready for 2025?
On April the 27th, the day this podcast is published, the mural on the wall at Fighting Cox will be unveiled. If you missed it, it's going to be there for a while, so why not walk out to Fighting Cox and have a look? On the 27th itself, between 10:30 and 2:30 in the afternoon, there will be a chance to learn about volunteering along the line. There'll be children's activities there and an author reading of Little Locals Big Day. That's me. This is all taking place on the railway path at Fighting Cocks, just to the rear of Sainsbury's convenience store. If you're driving there and you're not sure where you're going, the postcode is DL21JT.
On Saturday, May the 4th, we're going to have a big clean-up day at Hinton Station. This is just to remove broken glass and general rubbish from the outside of the building and tidy it up a bit. And it'll hopefully make it a safer place for Cleo and other dogs to visit who don't have shoes to protect their feet. Hopefully publicity for the event will encourage others to donate to our campaign as well.
Multinational and locally based business Husqvarna have offered to sponsor the next self-guided walks booklet, which covers Shildon to Hinton. We'll be fact-checking the old text in our old booklet by walking the line and using the train on the 11th of May. If you check out our events page on our website, you'll get more details. If you're already a member of the Friends of the SNDR, you'll get an email soon.
There's an open day at Appleby Station on the Settle Carlisle line on May 11th between 10 a.m. and 3 in the afternoon. Closer to home, there's a walk along the SNDR line from West Auckland on the 20th of May, meeting at the car park outside the Well coffee shop on the East Green in West Auckland. The postcode for that is DL149JD, and they meet there at 10:15 a.m. Sturdy footwear is essential. In fact, wellies might be better. The walk will go as far as Hammerbeck Railway Bridge and return, so not too far. There will be comfort stops at both Broom Mill Cafe and the former Station Master's House at St Helen, Auckland.
For some time, we've been trying to get a project off the ground at the site of the SNDR's first goods station, often called the merchandising station. This was located on North Road in Darlington, just next to the North Road Bridge next to Hopetown, and was commissioned in 1826 and built in 1827. Any guess who oversaw the works? None other than our friend John Falkus Carter from Hinton. The building was converted into a passenger station and workers' cottages in 1833, and sadly in 1864 it was demolished. It's now just a scrubby bit of land behind security fencing and not attractive at all. What we would like to do is tidy the site up, maybe do some trial excavations and see what, if anything, is left at foundation level of the building, then landscape it so that it's attractive. We've had so many meetings with so many people, and we'd like to thank Peter Gibson MP, who has kept at this for a long time. Well, things are beginning to happen. Network Rail have agreed to clear the site, and the Rail Heritage Trust have agreed to support us in investigating the site further and landscaping it.
That'll just make such a huge difference to that bit of North Road if that can get tidied up. And I can't wait to see how much survives of the merchandising station, if anything. Anyway, beautiful pens made by a descendant of John Carter, Andy Simmons, went up for sale, with proceeds going to the campaign to save Hinton Station. There are two styles, the engineer's pen and the director's pen, each £35. They're both made of specially selected oak and metal. They actually sold out in the same day that I put them up for sale on the website, but more are on their way. And when they've been made, you can buy them at the Friends website and just click on the shop tab. You'll find them. We also have some timber sourced from historic places along the SNDR and hope to add rather special pens using this timber very soon.
Well, was I absolutely gutted when I went on to try and buy those pens and found that they had sold out in absolutely no time whatsoever. So I'm very pleased to know that there's more coming as well. And as for the rather special ones, I think I'll probably have to book them early as well. Meantime, Darlington Borough Council have cleared graffiti along the line at Houghton Road, where the accommodation bridge is, known as the Arnold Road Underpass, or by its older, more attractive name, Throstle Nest Bridge.
The next issue of The Globe comes out in July, so it's time to start thinking about articles and other contributions for it. We've already received some great stuff, but more, as ever, is required. It doesn't have to be research. It could be transcriptions from old documents, railway recipes, poems about railways, preferably the Stockton and Darlington, reminiscences about the railway, reporting on your family history and any stunning pictures you might have taken.
And talking of stunning pictures, the Friends hope to publish a coffee table book on the SNDR for 2025. Local photographer Peter Giro is out there taking photos now for the book. But if you find you've taken a cracker, do let me know. We also hope to capture some poetry and possibly also sounds from the line, like birdsong. And another option might be the sound of locomotion number one travelling. We can add those things into the book as QR codes, which can be scanned, and then you can actually listen to them from the comfort of your home if you want to. And talking of stunning pictures again, the Friends have been donated 122 amazing black and white photos of the building of the replica locomotion number 1 in 1975 in Darlington. These have been made available to the Friends by the family of Mike Sato, who oversaw its construction. They're in the process of being put on the Friends website, so you'll be able to view them yourself. Just click on the Community Museum tab and then the Archives tab.
The next Friends monthly meeting will be 7 p.m, Thursday, 2nd of May, at Darlington Cricket Club. And of course, everybody is welcome. You don't need to be a member, but if there's anything important, you won't have a vote. But do join, because you get a book on the S&DR worth £7.99 and a lovely metal badge, which retails at £2.50. And they cost more than many of the membership options.
A couple of late news items just picked up this morning. Tees Cottage Victorian Pumping Station on Coniscliffe Road in Darlington is having their next open day on, well, two open days, May the 18th and May the 19th. Again, if you don't know where that is, you've probably driven past it loads of times, but it's at DL38TF. It's a stunning piece of Victorian engineering in there, really well worth going in to have a look. And photographer and friend of the Stockton and Darlington Railway, Elaine Visor, is exhibiting some of her work at Crown Street Library in Darlington from the 4th of May. And some of that has been inspired by the railway, so worth popping in and taking a look.
If I could just offer this, take this opportunity just to offer a brief thank you to all our volunteers and members. They're a fantastic bunch. They all do wonderful things. And while it's unfair to pick anyone out in particular, the Darlington group have really got going over the last few months, and they've been doing some fantastic work clearing the guided walk routes, which we popularised right in our booklets. So a big thank you to all our volunteers and helpers.
Stars of the SNDR.
Our star of the S&DR this month is John Falkus Carter, who designed and oversaw the construction of Hinton Station. Much of what we know about Carter is thanks to the research carried out by our late friend, Brendan Boyle. Brendan loved railways, he loved the S&DR, and he loved real ale, and these passions united for him with his research into S&DR taverns.
John Falkus Carter was born in Hinton and christened in St. Michael's Church there in 1787. His parents, Thomas Carter and Anne Nee Blakey, had married at Hinton in July 1786.
He was married to a Scottish woman, Jean Stewart, from Perthshire.
A person of taste, clearly.
Mm. The couple had eight children, Jane, Anne, Thomas, Matthew, Caroline, nice name, Margaret, John and William. They were all baptised in Hinton between 1812 and 1828. John was described in their baptismal records as a mason, one of two listed in the village in Parson and White's 1828 trade directory. On some occasions, he was described as a builder.
He certainly wasn't a trained architect or bridge surveyor, but an experienced stonemason. He must have stood out as someone literate and with good drafting and organisational skills to be taken on by the railway company. Clearly, he was well located to take on the works, with Hinton being close to the railway. There are also some hints that he had Freemasonry connections with at least one of the founding Pease family, and that might have helped too.
Carter designed and supervised S&DR projects along the whole length of the line. He was probably the world's most frequent railway passenger from 1825. It's unclear when Carter's association with the S&DR began, but in June 1824, he was engaged as contractor for a cottage at St. Helen, Auckland. I do wonder which building that was. Well, the following December brought a part-time engagement as Inspector of Works and Materials on the Skerne Bridge in Darlington, where he was still making changes to the bridge in May and June 1825, not long before the railway opened. He seems to have had concerns from the outset that the Skerne Bridge wasn't strong enough, concerns that would turn out to be true. Carter would have a strong ability to predict a problem.
In August 1825, he was producing plans for the depot buildings at St. John's Crossing in Stockton, including the warehouses at the depots there and the terminus of the Darlington branch line.
Subsequently, Carter and Thomas Story, see podcast number one, designed the Shildon workshops, with Carter designing the buildings, including the first group of cottages at New Shildon. That would include Timothy Hackworth's first house, and issuing the tenders for the works as late as September 1825, days before the railway opened. By November 1825, 2 months after opening, he was told to get a move on and employ more people to get the workshops completed at New Shildon. The committee were very dissatisfied by the progress, or lack of it.
By December 1825, he was making improvements to Shildon Lane at Eldon Colliery, and in that capacity he was working to instructions not just from the railway company, but because it was a road, also our local magistrate and the hero of Trafalgar, Captain William Price Cumbie.
Towards the end of March 1826, the S&DR were looking to dispose of Carter's services, but in June that year, the company went back to him and asked him to design 3 inns and 3 warehouses.
Regarding the warehouses, John Carter was instructed to draw up a specification and agreement for the work to be finished in 6 weeks' time. 6 weeks! The contractors to find lime, sand and scaffolding, but the railway company to find all other materials. At the same time, the S&DR adopted the plan for a cottage to be built at Aycliffe Lane, our station, and Carter was directed to agree terms with builders.
As we heard earlier, the building or cottage or railway station or inn at Hyington, level crossing on Aycliffe Lane, was originally designed to be a story taller than it is now, but the S&DR committee looked to drop it down to a single story. Carter advised against it, but was ignored. He thought it was a false economy and would save only £42.
Carter also suggested that they consult magistrates to ascertain whether a licence might be granted for the 2 inns that fell under the jurisdiction of Captain William Price Cumbie. Perhaps a conversation had been had. Perhaps Carter smelled a rat. As we know, the licence was refused until 1829, causing a major headache for the railway company, but undoubtedly saving a few headaches for engine drivers with a thirst.
Carter continued as inspector of buildings and oversaw the repair of dry stone walls along the railway company's boundaries at the west end of the line.
He explored the best place to provide a brewery near the Darlington depots. He oversaw the construction of a bridge in Mr. Trotter's farm at Midridge by Mr. Forster, where there were problems with poor workmanship.
And in a departure of masonry work, he is also recorded as caring for the Black Boy engine on the Black Boy branch line.
In July 1828, the S&DR company referred to him having already created additional sidings along the line at the eastern end so that it would be gradually become a regular double way. This is interesting because the line would not be fully doubled until 1832.
And do you know why there was such a delay? Well, the company minutes of the 17th July 1832 reported the double line of railroad was greatly retarded by the quarantine regulations in the winter. Otherwise, your committee would now have had the pleasure of announcing its completion. The quarantine regulations were to do with an outbreak of cholera, for which there was no cure. Cholera had arrived by boat in Sunderland in October 1831 and then proceeded to spread north and south. It would result in 31,000 deaths that winter in England, Scotland and Wales. It's extraordinary that economic productivity had been slowed down before on other major projects due to self-isolation to contain the spread of disease. Maybe the events of 2020 and lockdown were not so unprecedented after all.
Back to June 1828. The company felt once again there was not enough new building to warrant his services, but he could continue to manage the Black Boy engine.
Only 7 months later, on the 16th of January 1829, he was re-engaged for 1 day a week for the ensuing year at £52 in order to inspect all bridges and other masonry under construction. That included the Skern Bridge, which was showing signs of weakness. The bridge had been designed by Ignatius Bonhomie, who was an experienced architect of bridges, but only of road bridges. Carter had overseen the works and made changes to the design, but it hadn't been enough. Incidentally, and just to take you down a siding briefly, Ignatius Bonhomie was also the designer of Trafalgar House, where our licence-refusing hero of Trafalgar lived in Hyington.
The Skern Bridge needed new flanking walls, and Carter asked to delay the works, which were due to start in February, because the weather was still too bad. The works were put off until May.
It's worth bearing this in mind when you look at the famous painting by John Dobbin of the opening day of the S&DR. The bridge as he drew it, and painted it, was how it looked after John Carter made his alterations in 1829. Before that, the bridge was much simpler, so it's not a fully accurate reflection of the opening day.
His next career continued with his providing plans and specifications in February 1829 for a masonry bridge over the River Gonlis on the new Haggerleases branch. The tenders to build this bridge were awarded to Simpson and Carter. Confusingly, the Carter mentioned here is also a John Carter, also a mason, but it's not our John Carter. This is another John Carter, and he went on to build a number of S&DR bridges with Simpson. After our John Falcus Carter had died, This has caused some of us a lot of angst, I have to tell you, when doing research, and at one point it looked like a dead man was bidding for work.
Moving on, though, our John Carter also carried out alterations to the railway offices in Stockton and oversaw the building of a stable there for Mr. Peacock, who managed the warehouse.
His inspecting role finished at the end of 1829, and his subsequent involvement seems to have been solely as a contractor. His role as clerk of works was taken over by William Byrne.
There was more to Carter than the railway work, though. He was also a property owner in Hinton, and he did building work in the area, including considerably enlarging the vicarage at Gainsford. He was an insurance agent for a fire company as well. On October 1st, 1830, John Falkus Carter, mason of Hinton in the county of Durham, made a will. It was written by Francis Mewburn, the railway company's first solicitor, and his executor was none other than the hero of Trafalgar, William Price Cumby. Carter was only 43 and still had a young family. Was he terribly organised, or did he smell another rat?
Sadly, it was another rat. He died on the 23rd January 1831. He was only 44. The Durham Chronicle said his death was much regretted. He was described as a mason and a builder, but he was so much more for the S&DR.
He was buried at St Michael's in Hinton and supplied with an elaborate headstone, perhaps organised in advance and featuring symbols of masonry and Freemasonry.
His wife Jean went on to live until 1855 and died when she was 66. Carter left provision for her and his children in his will that his estate should be sold so she could have the funds. The auctions were held at the Bay Horse in Hinton, still there, folks, although it took several attempts for the sales to go through. Meanwhile, she appears to have run a grocer's shop in Hinton, possibly taken over from her mother-in-law.
So John Carter gave much of his life to the S&DR, and many of the structures that survive bear his hand. He gave sound advice that was often ignored and had a talent for predicting a problem. He was indispensable to the S&DR from 1824 until the end of 1829. Every time they thought they didn't need his services anymore and terminated his contract, they ended up having to ask him back again. It might have been ill health that finally brought his working relationship with the S&DR to an end. So if you're at a loose end, why not try to find the grave at St Michael's Churchyard in Hinton and then pop into the Bay Horse and raise a toast to John Carter?
Caroline, have you suggested drinking beer at every podcast so far?
Yes.
Tales from the Rails. This podcast you by the charity, the Friends of Stockton and Darlington Railway. Visit our website at www.sdr1825.org.uk.
That's it for another month. We hope you've enjoyed delving into the history of Hinton Station and John Carter. Remember, you can help prepare for 2025 by joining the Friends of the S&DR at www.sdr1825.org.uk. And you'll also find links there to our Save Hinton Station campaign.
And here's a reminder of some other useful contacts.
Kate Barrett is the S&DR Heritage and Community Participation Manager. She has an S&DR Community Fund which can provide grants a few hundred to a few thousand pounds and which are available over the next 4 years to help people celebrate and conserve the S&DR. If you have an idea, then get in touch with Kate and she'll provide initial feedback on your idea, and if it fits the community grant objectives, encourage you to submit an application.
The team of various officers in the local authorities include Nikki Halifax, the 2025 Festival Director. They can all be now contacted through one single email address, which is info@sdr200.co.uk, which people should use for any general inquiries.
And if you need help getting your S&DR facts right for your event or your business advertising, just contact the Friends of the S&DR via their webpage.
A big thank you, as always, to Dave Reynolds of the Railway Institute in Shildon for our theme music. And a special big thank you to Lee Morris, rapidly becoming our in-house actor, who quickly and at very short notice became Robert Metcalf, who witnessed the placing of Locomotion No. 1 on the rails in 1825. And thank you too to Niall Hammond, the chair of the Friends of the S&DR, for being our guest co-presenter today. I've been Caroline Hardy.
I've been Archie Mackay.
And I'm still Niall Hammond.
Hi, Cleo, wake up. Time to go.
Bonnie, time to go.